If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. This is August Baker, and today I'm talking with Professor Ronald Beiner about his book, Dangerous Minds, Nietzsche, Heidegger, and the Return of the Far Right, University of Pennsylvania Press. Welcome, Professor Beiner.
I'm happy to participate. Thanks so much for your interest in the book. That's great.
Yes, I actually listened to it in the summer, and I was using, I actually listened to it on audio. It comes in audio. I listened to it, sort of read it first. Yeah. Let me just, first of all, give the listeners an overview. These are some of the reviews of the book. And I'll just read three quick paragraphs here. One is from John McCormick, University of Chicago. Ronald Beiner's Dangerous Minds is a staggeringly impressive and deeply needed book that traces the philosophical foundations of contemporary reactionary politics to the philosophical works of Nietzsche and Heidegger. Beiner avoids both shrillness while confronting present-day opponents of liberal democracy and shallowness while excavating the work of their intellectual heroes. Indeed, he treats authors such as Julius Evola and Alexander Dugin with deathly seriousness, and he soberly and with exquisite philosophical care delves into the fundamental core of Nietzsche's and Heidegger's writings. Dangerous Minds is elegantly structured and beautifully written. It will be widely read and debated in this frightening age of fascist resurgence. Second one is Stephen Smith, Yale University. A great book. If it proves anything, it's that ideas have consequences, often profound and dangerous ones. One perhaps unintended benefit of the emergence of the new right is that it forces readers of Nietzsche and Heidegger to see them for what they are, apostles of a resurgent fascism. For those accustomed to reading these thinkers as prophets of individual liberation and moral self-realization, Ronald Beiner has a clear message, think again. And finally, from contemporary political theory, in this erudite, insightful, and short monograph, Ronald Beiner takes aim at often French-inspired intellectuals who believe that Nietzsche and Heidegger can and should be deployed to advance a progressive or radically democratic politics. Beiner believes that the two philosophers often serve as better resources for fascists. Dangerous Minds mounts its critique in the light of the recent rise of far-right movements, which often rely on Nietzsche and Heidegger for philosophical ballast. Professor Beiner, do you have any corrections or clarifications on those?
No, I kind of appreciate the generous reactions to the book, and right. I think they all kind of state what the basic enterprise is. So
good,
I'm comfortable with those generous blurbs. So.
Right. I understand that. I want to start off a paragraph from your book. You say, hopefully, no reader of my book will draw from it the unfortunate conclusion that we should just walk away from Nietzsche and Heidegger, that is, stop reading them. On the contrary, I think we need to read them in ways that make us more conscious of, more reflective about, and more self-critical of the limits of the liberal view of life, and hence what defines that view of life. Could you expand on that? I thought that was an interesting approach.
Yeah, happy to do that. I mean, someone actually said quite recently on a podcast where, you know, my book came up, said, I don't want people reading Nietzsche. I'm trying to dissuade people from reading Nietzsche. Well, that's just complete nonsense. I never said that. I never have said it. I never would say it. And it's kind of basically a slander. I've myself been reading Nietzsche and Heidegger my whole adult life. I mean, since I was, since I became a political theorist in my early 20s, you know, I've taught them. I taught, you know, the book came from a seminar, grad seminar I taught on Nietzsche. So if I'm teaching him, I want people to read him and read Heidegger and learn from them and draw from them insights that will be helpful in dealing with contemporary cultural and political crises, which you know, that's the context for the book. And that gives us extra reason to read them, try and understand what their essential message is and learn from them. And, you know, unfortunately, the people seem not to have gone the core message or think that, well, Nietzsche, there is no core message. He's just being playful, or he's just tossing out ideas, or he's a kind of contributing to a wonderful hyper pluralism or something like that. Well, I think that's just mistaken. And I think people who think that need to reread Nietzsche or reread both of them and understand better what the core vision is. And once we understand that, perhaps it'll be make it easier for us to cope with and respond to the kind of cultural and political crises we currently face. And that's why I wrote the book. If you're writing a book on them, if I just wanted to shoo them away and or not engage with them and not encourage other people to engage with them.
Right.
But I think the core insight one needs to get here is with respect to Nietzsche, to start with Nietzsche, and Heidegger in this respect is a kind of, you know, disciple of Nietzsche, political disciple of Nietzsche, and I think he understood himself in those terms, that there is a definite political project in Nietzsche. I mean, it's just shocking the number of commentators who refer to Nietzsche as he's apolitical, he's anti-political, there's no politics in Nietzsche, there's no political philosophy in Nietzsche. I mean, all that's just so totally wrong that it's hard to fathom how people could read this thinker and think such a thing. But and it may be that the majority of readers are somehow getting that crazy, you know, upside down idea of Nietzsche. I mean, so from there not being a politics or a political project in Nietzsche, that political project is what's powering, what's animating the whole thing. I mean, these thousands and thousands of pages he's writing, there's politics on every page of Nietzsche. And the core of his thought is that there is a political imperative to undo the cultural political dispensation in which we currently live, which is a kind of a liberal egalitarian dispensation inherited from the French Revolution. Liberal thinkers in the 19th century, such as Hegel and Tocqueville, assumed that dispensation was irreversible, that the world that we were launched into by the French Revolution cannot be undone and should not be undone, and it raises us to a normally higher level. Nietzsche thinks the opposite, that it's degrading, that it's dehumanizing, that it's impossible to have a culture in within the political, moral political horizons shaped by the French Revolution. And, you know, Nietzsche thinks that politics should be at the service of culture, but if you have the wrong kind of politics, you can't have culture. And what is taken to be culture in a liberal egalitarian world is a non-culture or pseudo-culture. Heidegger says the same thing, a moribund pseudo-civilization, he calls it. And the political project is to, you know, undo those horizons, undo that dispensation, so we can once again live in a culture, live in a world where culture is possible. I mean, for Nietzsche, culture is what everything is about, but culture has political conditions. If you live in a world where everyone thinks they're the equal of everyone else, I mean, for him, the only real culture is top-down cultures. And so if you live in a world where top-down cultures are unacceptable, then you live in a cultureless world. Mm. And I think Heidegger shared that view, and hence their political preoccupations were the same, that world has to be swept away, or it has to be raised, or you know, we have to start over, wipe the slate clean, and recreate a world where you can have real cultures. So the idea that this is unpolitical in any sense, that's just insanity. And you know, if most people, if that's what most people are getting out of Nietzsche, they really have to take another look at those texts and reread them, because they're missing, you know, they're missing the full forest for the trees. And yeah. And you know, I'm trying to set that straight, not because I don't want them to read Nietzsche, but I want them to come closer to a genuine understanding of what his enterprise is, such that they can then draw insights from that about our world that can help us respond to the crises of our liberal world.
Yes, I mean, I think you touched on this a little. It's not really the topic of your book, but you touched on it a little. What is it about us with our intellectual heroes that once we align with someone, we want to read it, everything they wrote, in a positive light? It's right. Difficult to see them complexly, it seems. I find that in myself. You know, I'm kind of like rooting for this particular philosopher or this particular thinker, and it's difficult to see where it's like you spend a lot of time with them, and then it's difficult to see where they're just totally wrong. And you end up wanting to defend them in some way.
I can totally understand that. Like I said, I spent decades, you know, reading Nietzsche and Heidegger, probably read more Nietzsche and Heidegger than reading anyone else. And I felt that in myself, that you don't want to think poorly of Nietzsche. He draws you into his net. You get seduced by him. He's a rhetorician of genius. And he knows what buttons to press and knows how to draw people's attention and how to keep their attention and how to make people feel drawn to him. And it's totally understandable. And so, you know, my way of thinking about the book was, you know, time to square accounts with Nietzsche, precisely because I was so drawn to and seduced by him myself. And so I totally understand that. But we, you know, the times in which we're living are sufficiently serious. The stakes are very high to understand what anti-liberal thinkers are really saying. I mean, there's much more extreme example than Nietzsche and Heidegger. Look at Carl Schmitt. Look at Carl Schmitt's reception in contemporary intellectual circles. You know, he said, left. Well, how did that happen? You know, he's much more evil than either of those two. You know, he was totally, totally committed Nazi. I mean, not that Heidegger wasn't, but Carl Schmitt's much worse. And yet he has the same, you know, loving defenders and you know, people apologizing to him, people kind of doing all kinds of somersaults to make him out to be a good guy and a healthy, you know, contributor to contemporary culture and theory. It's just insanity. And, you know, I'd view those, there's not much discussion of Schmitt in the book, but it's really a kind of trinity of people who being misguidedly appropriated by people, you know, theorists and intellectuals who should know better. All three of these guys belong very much to the far, not just the right, but the far right. And they themselves understood themselves that way. They all regarded liberalism and egalitarianism as a curse, and they were and shared the project of putting an end to it and undoing the hegemony of liberalism and of the idea of the freedom and equality of all human beings. They tested that idea. They saw it as the destruction of genuine culture. And we have to fight back, and in order to fight back, have to understand clearly what their project is.
Start with Nietzsche. What does the far right find in Nietzsche? Well, he writes, you quote him in Ecce Homo, that his text Beyond Good and Evil is in all essentials a critique of modernity. Mm-hmm. Encompassing the modern sciences, modern arts, and even modern politics. The purpose is to conjure up a contrary type that is as little modern as possible, a noble yes-saying type. White nationalists and fascists appear to be noble yes-saying types.
Well, I don't see them that way.
But, right.
You know, if a fascist is reading Nietzsche, they're going to see themselves, you know, inscribed in Nietzsche's pages. And, you know, when Nietzsche gave, I mean, often, you know, his descriptions are kind of cryptic or incomplete or, you know, just gestures towards something without filling in the details. But insofar as he does fill in the details, you know, it does fit what became fascism. You can't call Nietzsche a fascist because fascism didn't exist in the 19th century. But when it did come to exist, there's no question that fascists saw Nietzsche as articulating their project, their endeavor. You know, George Lichtheim wrote that not a single fascist from Mussolini to Oswald Oswald Mosley escaped Nietzsche's pervasive influence. Well, that's just a historical fact. I mean, you know, the influence of Nietzsche on fascism, that's not something hypothetical. That's just empirical. The breeding ground for what became fascism in the 30s was, what was called the conservative or has been called the conservative revolution in the 1920s. Those people were Nietzschean through and through in their self-understanding. And that fed into Nazism. Now, once Nazis, you know, once they saw Hitler and, you know, saw the Nazis in power, they didn't necessarily like what they saw. They maybe saw it as too plebeian, it wasn't aristocratic enough. But of course, you know, you're going to have these grand ideas of some wonderful aristocracy. Nietzsche himself did. So if Nietzsche was still around in the 30s, he might have, you know, looked down at his notes at the fascists and said, well, these, you know, this is more democracy. It's not aristocracy. But, you know, of course, setting some agenda for some aristocratic revolution that's going to overturn liberalism and overturn egalitarianism, well, you know, of course, it's not going to quite match what your grand vision was, and that would be true of Nietzsche, too. You know, but there are, you know, the kind of the rhetoric he does, you know, he said the great question is where do we look to for the barbarians of the 20th century? He wanted barbarians. He praises barbarians. He praises, you know, Vikings or civilizations that had you know, no qualms about shedding blood. That's a kind of almost a test of, you know, that was part of the tragic vision that we can have fight wars and be up to our knees in blood and not worry about it. Feel that it's part of what it is to have a civilization. And so
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
In terms of the rhetoric that is appealing to the far right, you have this quote from an early Nietzsche text on the uses and disadvantages of history for life, and talking about, you might say, the modern liberal, this is what the people on the right say, the modern liberal can no longer extricate himself from the delicate net of judiciousness and truth for a simple act of will and desire.
Right.
Is that what you think?
There's no question that Nietzsche wants to reorient the core of human life from reason to will. I mean, that's the whole idea, the will to power, that if you live in a civilization that's dominated by intellect and reflection and science and reason,
that Dr. Fauci
feed civilization and hence a kind of pseudo-civilization. And the test is whether, you know, can you have a kind of civilization that, I don't know, builds pyramids? You know, well, to have pyramids, you need slaves. And to have slaves, you can't believe in equality. You have to believe that, you know, that there's a kind of top-down dictation of cultural norms. And there have to be people who are mere instruments of that. And if you can't believe, I mean, liberalism undermines a belief in the kind of top-down vision of things that make it possible for there to be cultures, any cultures. And, you know, where does liberalism come from? Well, it ultimately comes from Christianity, you know, mediated through the Reformation, then the Enlightenment, then the French Revolution. But ultimately, it's traceable back to Christianity and the belief that we're all equal children of God. Well, those for Nietzsche, those are culture destroying premises, and they have to be destroyed. So he declares war on Christianity. What's the reason for that? Well, that too is political. That if you start with the premises of Christianity, what you end up with are you know, liberalism as egalitarian liberalism as a general dispensation, and that means no culture. only, you know, people have to be ruthless and impose their will and strive for the heroic and strive for grand visions of things. I mean, that's what the fascists were trying to do. Look at their architecture. You know, Nietzsche said, well, look, at least they're trying to be a real civilization. Yet they aspire to be around for 1,000 years. Well, no liberal civilization is going to aspire to that. So, you know, in that sense, they were trying to, and they hated Christianity for precisely Nietzsche's reasons. And it's a very powerful book, you know, my book on Nietzsche and Heidegger is very short. 1,000-page book by Domenico Lazzardo called Nietzsche, the Aristocratic Rebel, in which kind of spells out, you know, that how Nietzsche is political through and through. And if you're not persuaded by my little book, well, I'd encourage people to read the 1,000 pages of Lazzardo and, you know, very incisive account of what the fascists owe to Nietzsche. It's all spelled out, I think, in an utterly compelling way, in a way that's, I think, irrefutable. And, you know, it's not an accident that fascists historically have looked to Nietzsche as an inspiration, including Mussolini, including Hitler himself, went to the Nietzsche archives and warmly embraced Nietzsche's sister and had himself photographed with a post, you know, a bust of his hero. And, you know, and contemporary fascists all love Nietzsche. There's nothing accidental about that. And they have a good case for him belonging to them rather than belonging to us, you know. It's all fully intelligible why fascists, whether, you know, fascists of the 20s and 30s or fascists in the 21st century would find inspiration from Nietzsche. And it all makes sense. I mean, Nietzsche's fundamental purpose as an intellectual, as a philosopher, is to delegitimize equality. And in order to do that, he has to delegitimize Christianity. That's the twin project. Everything flows from that. And if you can't see that as being at the core of Nietzsche's project, I don't think you can understand anything in Nietzsche. You have to appreciate what the core is, because there is a core. It's not just, you know, playful pluralism. There is a hard core there. There's a political project in Nietzsche, no less than there's a political project in Marx. For Marx, the political project is to carry forward to the next stage the egalitarianism of liberalism. And Nietzsche, it's the opposite. The commitment, the civilizational commitment to equality has to be completely annulled, has to be completely annihilated in order that there be real cultures. And, you know, I think fascists see themselves as carrying that baton and putting it into practice and trying to put Nietzsche's theory into action. And, you know, whether Nietzsche would have been impressed, you know, entirely happy with the results, well, that's a different question. But then, you know, would Marx be happy with Stalinism?
Right.
That's not the point, you know. The right. point is there is a vision there, and the fascists saw themselves as trying to realize what Nietzsche had articulated normatively.
Would you say that both for Marx and Nietzsche, they were long on criticism and short on how the new world is going to be?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, you could say that's a kind of parallel between them, that they're both writing blank checks, very dangerous blank checks.
Yes.
And, you know, Nietzsche said that the 20th century would be, you know, an ideological war, the likes of which would had never been seen in human history. And that was more or less true. I mean, that was pretty prophetic. And the idea is, well, you have, you know, the Marxists on one side and you'd have the fascists on the other and you'd have the liberals in the middle who would be irrelevant, that the and that he was on one side of that ideological war. So the problem is, you know, for Nietzsche as much as for Marx, you know, they're both utopians, but they don't fill in the content of this utopia. All the emphasis is on destroying the existing order.
Mm.
you know, for Marx, we wipe out capitalism, but then what succeeds capitalism? Well, you know, we find out later, you know.
And right.
The Leninism and Stalinism in the case of Nietzsche, same story, you know, that they're very powerful cultural critique. Sure, let's destroy liberalism. Then what? Well, then we get Mussolini and Hitler. I mean, you know, Nietzsche didn't spell out, well, if you, you know, follow this path, you're going to wind up with Hitler. He just, there, you know, there's this idea of, well, we'll get to the further shore, you know, well, we'll figure it out when the arrow hits the further shore. Well, by the time you get to the further shore, sorry, it's too late. And so, yeah, it's that part of what makes them attractive as theorists is, you know, there's a kind of tremendous kind of ambition and reaching for the stars and kind of, you know, climbing Mount Everest culturally and intellectually. And that's part of what defines our theory tradition. But the theory tradition's dangerous precisely because, you know, you get in the theory canon by virtue of your ambition, but then that can turn out to be politically ambitious if all you've done is write a bunch of blank checks. And I think both Nietzsche and Marx did that.
Yeah,
paid the price for it in the 20th century. You
yes.
know? And I think not just the 20th century, we're still,
right.
You know, there's no guarantee right this moment that the 21st century won't be a replay of the 20th century. God help us if it is, but there's, you know, plenty to suggest that the 21st century could turn out to be as horrifying as the 20th century was. I mean, let's, you know, again, that's part of
be realistic.
Why I wrote the book.
Is right.
Well, here we go again. It's like Weimar all over again, where you get intellectuals. I mean, I guess like any, you know, like most liberals, like the assumption was, well, fascism, that'll never happen again. It's in the rubbish bin of history. It'll stay in the rubbish bin of history. And, you know, we wouldn't go to the extent of Fukuyama that, you know, liberal democracy will reign forever. That was, you know, I think obvious nonsense from the start. But certainly, you know, the idea of there being fascist intellectuals trying to, you know, pull fascism out of that rubbish bin of history, that was sort of beyond my imagination. And then I don't know, starting in 2015, more or less, and then, you know, it got worse after Trump was elected, you start thinking, well, fascist intellectuals do exist, and it's back. And it's back not just, you know, in with respect to mob behavior, but it's back with respect to intellectual activity. That was a very, you know, scary realization for me. And I wrote this book, I guess, as a kind of feeling, a kind of citizen's imperative to say something or do something, or with the equipment I had to say, well, we better, you know, wake up and smell the coffee.
Yep. One of the, I think really one of the points you made that was, I thought really interesting was you said Nietzsche puts a lot of energy into exposing liberal and leftist resentment, but he turned a blind eye toward or was silent about the resentments of the right, including his own. I was like, yes.
It's pretty hard not to see all the resentment in the pages of Nietzsche. And for him, it's kind of that's the standard of, you know, the things that he rejects supposedly are defined by resentment, and all the business about yay saying, and, you know, that's the opposite of resentment. Well, you know, his texts are not always, not every page, but there's plenty of resentment packed into Nietzsche's texts, and it delegitimizes him according to the standard he himself is applying. And, you know, he's not as yay saying as he makes himself out to be. I mean, there's this rhetoric of yay saying, but he doesn't live up to that rhetoric. And, you know, I think that's true of, you know, the political legacy he's left. I mean, up till the present, you know, right-wing populism is powered more than anything by resentment against, you know, supposed, you know, liberal elites, you know, who are running the world and so on. Well, you know, a lot of that you can actually trace back to Nietzsche. I mean, he was you know, completely ignored in his own time. No one, hardly anyone knew who he was.
What a miserable life.
Yeah, not a fun life. It's a lonely life. And I think he bitterly resented the fact that he wasn't being treated as the intellectual giant that he took himself to be. I mean, he was right, you know, he was right that people would start reading him in the 20th century. In fact, regard him as one of the leading thinkers of his time. But
he only barely saw that, I think, before he went mad. Just briefly did he right. realize that he was becoming successful, as I understand it.
Well, he went mad in 1889. I don't think there was much. I mean, there, yeah, hardly any knows.
Hardly, right.
Just starting. I mean, it really, you know, picked up in the 1890s. And then as one gone to the 20th century, he took off and became perhaps the most influential thinker of the 20th century, or one of the most influential thinkers.
You talked about culture, and one of the things that you say was that Nietzsche would say that modern liberals are too reflective about their membership in cultures and about the equal validity of alternative cultures. We do talk a lot about culture, but not in the way I was trying to think how, you know, with all the talk of multiculturalism, how that fits in with his critique of cultures.
Well, again, I think that you can draw a direct line from that to the contemporary far right. I mean, this is, I think, in this sense, they're precisely, you know, Nietzscheans in the strict sense that, you know, part of what we associate with modernity and part of why Nietzsche condemns modernity is one's trying to ascend to a kind of universalism where we can appreciate different cultures and what, you know, different communities within the human world have to contribute to a larger conversation and a larger human experience and a kind of impartiality. Well, you know, I think here you could see Heidegger as an intellectual heir to Nietzsche, that real cultures are so deeply rooted that they don't see outside of themselves, don't see outside of their own
horizon,
want to.
Interesting.
And the core idea, which I trace back to Houston Disadvantage of History for Life, because it's articulated very well there, but it's, you can, I kind of draw text from across Nietzsche's oeuvre, the idea of horizon. That you know, test of real culture is it's so convinced of its own, you know, normative superiority that it's just not interested in looking beyond itself. Well, you know, the core, to talk about Heidegger for a minute, you could say the central rhetoric in Heidegger is that modern man is homeless. You know, this is you get this idea in his important letter on humanism, that homelessness is the core modern experience. And again, it's like for Nietzsche, is what condemns modernity. I mean, for Nietzsche, what condemns modernity is there are no horizons, that the universalism that has been introduced into Western experience by Christianity has dissolved horizons. I mean, the horizon for much of Christianity was the idea of God itself, and God's dead, and we're left with nothing, and we're just left with some kind of residues of a Christian civilization, but those are fast eroding. And so we're left just drifting. And so our kind of supposed openness to a variety of cultures shows we have no culture. We have no horizons of our own. We live in this horizonless world. Well, Heidegger, similarly, we kind of live in this homeless world where everyone's trying to be, you know, universal, and they're not rooted in any particular, you know, definite cultural identity or cultural experience of their own. And, you know, the kind of far right attack on multiculturalism, I think, just draws straight out of that. I mean, one of these alt-right thinkers, Greg Johnson, said that the originator of the European New Right is Heidegger, and I think that's a plausible claim, but I think, you know, you can trace similar preoccupations back to Nietzsche, and I try and do that in the book.
And I think, and I'll just, as we go to Heidegger, I think immediately of Rorty, who in the New York Times said, similar to you, this, in the sense that we're not trying to say don't read Heidegger, but Rorty said, Heidegger's books will be read for the next, for centuries to come, but the smell of smoke from the crematories, the grave in the air, referring back to Paul Celan's Death Fugue, the grave in the air will linger on their pages.
Well, I think that's true. You know, I think, I discuss in the book how some of the most incriminating texts in Heidegger were, taken out by Heidegger in the 60s. And then when they put together, you know, the collected works in the 80s, they were put back in. And, you know, I think that tells you a lot about Heidegger, that he was never prepared to admit, you know, that he had made any mistakes. He was silent about the Holocaust, or insofar as he, you know, he did, people forced, you know, commentary out of him. It was kind of even more incriminating than silence. I think it relates to what I was saying earlier, that the core project is to destroy of a liberal egalitarian world founded on the idea of a universal dignity of human beings, the commitment to fascism is actually not some ornament or some, you know, add-on, but connects quite centrally to what his fundamental project was. In a sense, if fascism didn't work out in the 20th century, well, his thought will still be around centuries later, and some later version will have to try and do what what Hitler and Nazis failed to do in the 30s. I mean,
Rorty also says, he lied over and over again about his Nazism, that he did his best to ignore the murder of the European Jews. But for those who care about philosophy, things are not so simple. He says, as far as whether to read him, and this is, again, getting back to your point, he managed to write books that are as powerful and as original as Spinoza's or Hegel's. And you can't understand really Gadamer or Levinas, Arendt, Foucault, Derrida, Habermas, without reading Heidegger. That's what Rorty was saying.
I pretty much agree with all that. I mean, yeah, we should read him. He earned his place in the canon of Western philosophy. And I think it's almost certainly correct that people will read him long from now, just as they read Aristotle or read Hegel. And I wouldn't want to expel him from the canon. I wouldn't want to, you know, pull his books out of the library one prominent critic of Heidegger suggested. So, I think that's right. I mean, there's a reason why people read him, and there's a reason why he's been essential to 20th century philosophy as he's been, and why he's had the tremendous influence he's had on a whole generation of philosophers, many of whom I kind of cherish. And,
right.
And shaped my own career as a theorist. So
right.
You don't want to wipe all that away or wish it away. He's same for Nietzsche. I mean, they're indispensable, part of the history of modern philosophy.
Right.
That's not a reason to try and whitewash them.
Exactly.
Or apologize for them or kind of pretend that the project was something different than what it really was.
Right. No, absolutely.
Look at that clear-sightedly and face up to it. and understand why these thinkers have such attraction for people who are not good liberals, but who are ferociously anti-liberal. And those people are on the rise and, you know, have a big and growing following. And if they understand themselves and Nietzsche and Heidegger in terms, we have to understand that. And maybe, if necessary, reread Nietzsche and Heidegger until we're clear about it. And trying to contribute in my modest way to that.
That's certainly the way I understood it. It was fascinating. I wish we don't have time, but for the listener, there's an interesting anecdote you have about your own personal interactions with Gadamer and Habermas, which is quite interesting. We're out of time, unfortunately, but I was just wondering, what are you working on now? Freud, is that?
I'm writing a book called Moses and Political Philosophy, looking at the whole diversity of appropriations of the Moses story within the Western theory canon. And I'm co-writing it with my friend Harrison Fluss. And so Freud figures in that, because of course he wrote.
Sure. So Freud did write the Moses and monotheism, and
yeah, Moses that'll be in monotheism, right? So that's why he kind of gets included in the book.
But yes,
on a broader story of how Moses intersects with Western theory.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Professor Beiner. Thank you so much for talking with me. It was really interesting, and I really enjoyed the book, and appreciate what you've done with that.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your interest in it, and pleasure chatting with you.